This meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It's 3:08 on Tuesday, March 7th, in the Capitol Room 108. Members present are Representative Keto, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Eastman, Representative Edgman, Representative Johnston, and myself, Representative Sponholz. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. We're also joined by the esteemed esteemed colleague from Eagle River, Representative Dan Sadler. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Before we get started, I want to thank Caitlin Ellis, the House HES Secretary from Records, and Alex Bibi Gudice from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today, and as always, Ted Sadler from my office, who is the committee aide.
Madsen.
Oh my gosh.
That was awkward. Ted Madsen. I didn't mean to, like, put you all together in a way that was uncomfortable for everybody involved. So today we're going to be hearing two bills and a presentation. First up is a presentation from Kate Burkhart, who's the Executive Director of Alaska's Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, and Tom Chard, Executive Director of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. They're going to be presenting on the substance abuse treatment system in the state of Alaska. Then we're going to turn our attention to HB 138, which designates March as Sobriety Awareness Month. We'll be hearing from the bill sponsor and invited testimony, and then we'll be setting the bill aside so we can hear public testimony on a later date. The second bill up will be a continuation of the bill HB 43, which is new drugs for the terminally ill. We'll hear a brief recap of the bill from the bill's staff, close out public testimony, discuss any amendments, and then look to the will of the committee. Now I'd like to invite Ms. Burkhart and Mr. Chard to come up for their presentation on substance abuse treatment in the system. I want to encourage committee members to ask clarifying questions only during the presentation, and then if you have substantive questions, to bring them up after the fact. We want to give them a chance to get through everything. But before Ms. Burkhart and Mr. Chard start, I want to just say just a couple of things briefly, and that is that we've focused a lot of attention recently on the opioid epidemic that we're facing in the state as well as a nation recently, and that deserves a lot of attention. Opioid addiction is very, very difficult to treat. Its impacts on families are heartbreaking, and the growth of its impact on our state has been very, very rapid in a way that we don't see very often. But I want to take this moment to remind everybody that the number one drug of choice in the state of Alaska and across the nation remains alcohol. Alcohol is a huge drain on our state. There was a study done in 2012 by the McDowell Group, which was actually prepared for the Alaska Mental Health Board and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, which Ms. Burkhart staffs. And some of the initial findings were that 9.5% of Alaska's population age 12 and older in 2009 was dependent on or abusing alcohol and drugs. Cost to the economy in 2010 totaled $1.2 billion. That's billion with the B in the way that we typically use it in this building. That's staggering. The cost by category included $673 million in productivity losses, $50.5 million in traffic cost loss, traffic crash costs, $2.7 million in criminal justice and protective services costs, $237.3 million in health care, and $13.2 million in public assistance and social services. That's staggering. And this is for a drug that is legal, that is available over the counter in our state, and we still have failed to get a hold on it. So I think given the cost to our state and in our current fiscal situation, it behooves us to take a little time to investigate the issue of alcoholism in our state and what our response system is for it, and that's why I asked Mr. Chard and Ms. Burkhart to join us today. And with that, I'll thank you and hand the mic over to you.
Thank you, Chair Sponholz, and the entire committee for inviting us for this important topic. My name is Tom Chard. I'm the director of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. It's a trade association of sorts made up of mental health and drug and alcohol providers across the state. We've got about 60 members currently. These are for-profit and non-profit, tribal, non-tribal providers scattered all over, from the smallest clinics to the largest service providers. We serve folks from kids all the way through adults and seniors, and looking forward to this presentation, this discussion today. Thanks.
And my name is Kate Burkhart. I am the Executive Director of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, as well as the Alaska Mental Health Board. And we were invited to share with the committee an overview of the substance use disorder treatment system, as well as how people reach recovery. And so how we hope to do that today is to tell a story. And in the telling of this story, which is based on information we actually receive from people who've made this journey towards recovery, we hope to provide an overview of how the system works, where it works well, and where it has weaknesses, where we can share one person's perspective of the journey to recovery. For each person, it is a unique road, and for some people, it's bumpier than others. And also the perspective of providers. So as we tell this story, which is primarily from the person's perspective, we will pause to ensure that the provider perspective is also included, and hopefully that will give you a better picture of how the system works. Before we get to the story, I think it's important to have some context, like the chair provided. Using the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, we estimate that about 11.5% of Alaskan adults, that's a little over 60,000 people, need substance use disorder treatment. Of those, more than a third have a co-occurring mental illness, which makes treating their substance use disorder more complicated, because they have either a serious mental illness like schizophrenia or a moderate mental illness, which can be anything from depression to anxiety to a situational mental health disorder to mild mental illness. What we know is that mental health disorders and substance use disorders travel together more often than they travel apart.
Clarifying question?
Yes, just for clarification, that's a big number, and I'm concerned, how did the National Survey on Drug Use and Health come with this estimate?
Thanks for the question, through the chair, Representative Johnston. The National Survey on Drug Use and Health contacts individuals in Alaska and asks them a battery of questions and determines, based on a clinical approach, who might be substance abuse dependent, who might be abusing substances, and who might have a disorder. It's a statistical study that uses research that's way above my pay grade, that they do on both a trend basis for Alaska as well as state-by-state comparisons. So we're fairly confident in these numbers. It's a SAMHSA and CDC generated study of all the states.
So are these surveys random surveys, random telephone surveys?
Through the chair, yes, they're statistically randomized, so that they're trying to get in Alaska, because of our population and population density, they actually oversample to make sure that they're not that they're statistically valid numbers. And I can get more information about the actual survey itself to you, if that would be helpful.
That'd be interesting. Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, now, how old are these numbers, and what does 11.5% get us in the state ranking?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, this is the most current information, and I would have to follow up with state ranking information.
Thank you.
And through the chair, just to add on to that, I think these are the 2014-2015 survey results, which as Ms. Burkhart responded, are most recent. And again, we can get you more information on the NESDA numbers.
Thank you.
I appreciate the question earlier comparing the estimates of Alaskan adults that need substance use disorder treatment services, because as you see at the bottom of the slide, state-funded programs that provided substance use disorder treatment services only provided them to about 7,808 individuals. We can count that fairly accurately with our state system. I would note that these are the state-funded programs. There are private practitioners out there that do not receive state funds that use either third-party insurance or private pay to provide these services. They are a critical part of this, but for our presentation and for the purposes of our discussion today, we're focused on public-sourced funds.
Is this a clarifying question?
Clarifying question. Are you including that 7,800 tribal funds or federal funds?
Yes, through the chair, yes, ma'am.
Another important part to setting the stage is the impact of adverse childhood experiences, not just on our population as a whole, but on the population that seeks services through the substance use disorder treatment system. So based on the behavioral risk factor surveillance system, which, like the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, is a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention tool that has been used for years, that samples adults and asks a battery of questions and then compiles the data. Since 2013, we have been asking questions related to adverse childhood experiences that the person being surveyed experienced in their childhood. And that data tells us that two-thirds of Alaskans report one or more adverse childhood experience. An adverse childhood experience can range from the death of a parent, which is traumatic, to child abuse and neglect, or other things like the incarceration of a parent. It's not limited just to child abuse and neglect. 21.4% of Alaskan adults report growing up in a household with an adult who experiences mental illness. Almost 30% report growing up in a household with one or more adults abusing alcohol or other drugs. And we have almost 20% of all Alaskan adults reporting four or more adverse childhood experiences growing up. If you've had the chance to attend any of the many conversations and presentations and reports on the adverse childhood experiences, you know that there's a dose response. So it's a compounding effect. The more you have in your life, there is a compounding effect. And this is important because as we tell the story, you'll find that our person has adverse childhood experiences in her background. So our story is about Martha. And Martha is a composite of actual clients. She was created by the members of the group that helped write the concept paper for the 1115 demonstration waiver for behavioral health Medicaid reform and redesign. So she's not a real person, she's a composite person. She lives in a small rural community in western Alaska. She's had adverse childhood experiences in her past. She has dealt with untreated depression, a moderate mental health disorder. She lives with her mother, who is also dependent on alcohol. Martha has a DUI conviction. It's 5 years old. And while she doesn't always receive the services she needs for her depression, she's a frequent user of the health clinic, going in for a whole host of physical ailments and pain over time. And she does meet with the itinerant mental health provider periodically.
So Ms. Burkhart spoke about the adverse childhood experiences and that effect that it has on the household. There are some missed opportunities already in Martha's story. In the narrative that we've provided, just as a sneak peek, we mentioned the mother is dependent on alcohol. We mentioned the adverse childhood experiences. We mentioned the DUI. These are all examples of missed opportunities where we could intervene fairly early in this story to have a much more cost-effective, but more importantly, effective treatment outcome and mitigate the impact of this person's problem in their life. There's some other missed opportunities listed on the slide, but we wanted to take the opportunity here today in this discussion to talk about the value of early intervention and prevention.
And we will talk a little bit more about this as we get deeper into Martha's story, but it's important to understand that the substance use disorder treatment system we have now is funded and designed to serve the most acutely addicted. So our priority populations are those that are at the highest level of need. We don't have a system that is designed or funded to take advantage of these early opportunities for intervention. So as we go through the story, you'll see this arrow with the dots. You can't really see the arrow on the wall. To help us know where we are on our journey. This would imply it's a lovely linear process. It is not a lovely linear process. It is often a herky-jerky back and forth process. But for the purposes of the presentation, we thought it would be helpful to label the stages and show where we are in the stages. So Martha has come to a period of what we call pre-readiness. She knows she has a problem, and she's freaked out about it. She went through an episode where she couldn't get her prescription opioids on which she has become dependent, and she was actually thinking about trying to find some street heroin because she was that bad off. And that really scared her. She didn't have anybody to talk to, and she started to feel suicidal and didn't have the people in her life or the skills to seek help. Somehow she gets through that. She has an appointment at the health clinic for a somatic problem. And the provider, who knows Martha, because she comes into the clinic pretty frequently, decides, you know, maybe now we're at a point where we can administer a substance abuse screening as part of the appointment, and she'll be receptive to that. And so they do. And the conversation, which these conversations often use something called motivational interviewing, which is an evidence-based practice clinicians can use to help people develop and take advantage of their pre-readiness or their readiness to move toward treatment. And so at that point, Martha feels comfortable and safe, and she discloses she's dependent on alcohol and other drugs, particularly the prescription opiates, and she's scared of what's going to happen if she doesn't get help.
So in our narrative, Martha at this point divulges the fact that she might have a substance abuse problem to her healthcare provider. This in the industry is known as the moment of clarity, or a moment of clarity. As Ms. Burkhart mentioned, this is not a linear path. Sometimes we come back and forth on this, but a lot of the discussion that's happened around substance abuse treatment services and the importance of meeting that individual at that exact moment, this is the moment they're talking about. So that moment of clarity is an opportunity for our treatment system in our state to intervene so that hopefully we will turn the tide on the cost and the impact on the individual, their family, and their community. The problem is that in some of the NESDA numbers earlier and some of what we deal with as a treatment system, a lot of people don't recognize that they actually have a substance abuse problem. Of the people that do recognize they have a substance abuse problem, some of them don't seek treatment. And then finally, of that category, the folks that do seek treatment are responded to with wait lists or with challenges to get the treatment. And the challenges could be as simple as childcare or employment or housing, or there's a host of them. So we've got some rough numbers from some studies that have been done. They're displayed here that only about a third recognize they need treatment, tried to get treatment. The Matsu Health Foundation did an excellent environmental scan up in the valley and showed us these numbers again with their survey results. So we're pretty confident that both nationally and regionally this is a fairly good indicator. So the issue is, as a treatment provider, to meet that individual at their moment of clarity when sometimes that moment might pass in a blink of an eye.
Okay.
I can do this.
No. So we've had this moment of clarity. Martha is ahead of the game in this story because she is hooked into a healthcare provider already. If you are not hooked into a healthcare provider and you have a moment of clarity at 2 in the morning, all by yourself, you won't have a process like this because you won't already be hooked into a system that can help you navigate towards substance use disorder treatment. And we'll talk about later about what you do if you're not hooked in. But just recognize that Martha's already ahead of the game because she is receiving some sort of healthcare service, and she is lucky enough to receive that service in an integrated health system where her primary care provider can link her to a behavioral health provider. So her clinic provider is able to call the behavioral health department at the larger health organization, get her an appointment for her initial intake and assessment on Wednesday. and then Martha doesn't come. And that is a standard eventuality, and it goes back to what Tom was talking about around the clarity, that moment of clarity. It's fleeting. So Martha goes to the clinic the next Tuesday, and she doesn't have an appointment, and so they're not able to respond right away, but they do their best. They get some intake information, and they try again, and she gets an appointment on Thursday, and this time she comes even though she's late. The counselor is able to talk with her, but then realizes, based on her history, she needs more of an assessment than just a basic substance abuse assessment. She needs an integrated mental health and substance abuse assessment. So they make an appointment with a mental health professional through telehealth for the next week. And our timeline in this story is based on information from providers in the last couple of months about how quickly they're seeing people and what their wait times are.
So I was mentioning to the chair and to Ms. Burkhart on my way in this morning that, you know, when I was in high school, unfortunately, I was the kid with the backpack full of books every day. And not to disappoint, I, again, have brought a backpack full of books. In this particular example, Martha meets for the integrated behavioral health assessment via telemed. We wanted to take this opportunity in the presentation to talk just briefly about some of what goes into that behavioral health assessment. In your packet, you've actually got an integrated behavioral health assessment just as a reference. So our system has mental health assessments, substance abuse assessments, and then an integrated assessment. These are all trained counselors and clinicians doing these assessments, and they're based on things like the DSM-5 or the Diagnostic Statistic Manual 5th version. More germane maybe to our conversation today is the ASAM criteria. And the ASAM criteria, one of the things that's in here that I'm always stealing from is a level of care instrument that we'll talk about in a second. But essentially, the ASAM, the DSM, and to a lesser degree, the ICD-10, these are statistical manuals that our trained clinicians and counselors use to figure out all of the dimensions that this person needs treatment for, and what goes into, you know, all of the things that assess their level of treatment need. And then they look at local resources, state resources, and national resources that are available to try to plug them into what might meet the best treatment outcome. So I wanted to bring these, and feel free to thumb through them later if you want. We can I can pass them around. My friends over at the Division of Behavioral Health lent me these books. They're pretty pricey otherwise. So when the trained counselor does the ASAM, one of the things that they'll do is they'll find a level of care corresponding to the individual's need. So a lot of times we're, you know, folks on the street, folks that are in need, family members and loved ones, say, we need detox. Well, it may not be that they actually need detox. It may just be that they need substance abuse treatment services. And if you look, so the way that this level of care instrument is organized, on the far left column, it increases in intensity from early intervention at a 0.5, through some of the outpatient services, intensive outpatient, which sometimes is characterized as IOP or intensive outpatient, partial hospitalization, and then you get into your residential, your threes are pretty, your residential, and then the withdrawal management services, which are toward the end of that scale. Unfortunately, as Ms. Burkhart mentioned, our substance abuse treatment system is mostly geared toward the deep end of the pool, and so we typically end up catching folks a little later than we would like in the treatment system. That being said, we do have a number of outpatient treatment service providers, a number of residential providers, and a few detox or withdrawal management service providers that we'll talk about here in a sec. So just as an example of some of the treatment providers that we have operating around the state, we've got a sobering center up in Bethel. We have another one opening in Fairbanks in 2017. The ones, the indents where you see one will open and one will open one, that's due to the three-year capital funding that last year was put into the budget. We've got three withdrawal management centers. These are detox centers, 21 residential treatment centers, to nonprofit medication-assisted treatment. So this is Fairbanks and Anchorage, two private for-profit MAT providers, and two OCS-engaged parent treatment providers in Anchorage and Mat-Su. So a lot of these treatment providers, you know, in conversations and discussions I have with folks, they ask this general question of, well, who's doing the best job, and can't we just fund that organization and not fund the rest? It's important to understand that because of funding and a bunch of policy decisions, all of these treatment providers are actually acting in concert to try to provide the care that the person needs. It's very rare that there is one or multiple organizations in the same community providing the same service. It's more common that, you know, in Fairbanks there'll be this, and then in, you know, Palmer there'll be that kind of thing, and the clients kind of go between the systems. And we'll illustrate that with Martha's story as we continue this.
And before we move on, because we are trying to focus pretty narrowly on the publicly funded behavioral health services, so there is a sobering center in Anchorage that's funded by the municipality, so that doesn't appear on your slide. We also did not try to quantify the number of private practitioners or community health centers that are not also behavioral health centers that may be providing physician-based medication-assisted treatment. So that's a separate category of service. So based on this assessment that Tom has described, her clinicians determined that because of her dependence on both alcohol and opioids, she needs withdrawal management services, which is an intensive level of service at the higher end of the spectrum. So she can't get that in her village, and she actually can't get that in her hub community. And so she's really nervous about having to go to one of the big cities, Anchorage, Juneau, or Fairbanks, because she realizes that there's an opportunity to divert from treatment and to use. That right there is a level of insight that a lot of people don't have. So Martha, again, is not necessarily stereotypical about realizing that just getting to the initial service she needs could be a barrier to even getting started. It's also an important place in her treatment process because when she says, oh, I don't know about going to town, like that might be really bad for me, there's a kind of a crux in the road. She can either go to the level of care that the clinical assessment says will work for her, or she can say, I can't do that. I can't leave, whether it's because I'm afraid to go or because I have kids or whatever it is. And she could attempt to receive services at a lower level of care that may or may not help her because it's not designed for someone with the acuity of need that she has. So that's kind of a crossroads in the road that many people face. So she agrees to go to the withdrawal management program, mostly because we want to show you the whole system. There are 34 withdrawal management beds in Alaska today, and they're available in Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. And with the funding that Tom referenced, there will be additional beds in Soldotna later this year. There are some hospitals that are able to do medically monitored detox if they absolutely have to, based on the medical need of the person that presents. These are the beds, though, that are in designated treatment providers.
So that 34 withdrawal management beds, that serves the entire population of the state of Alaska. And so when we hear that there aren't enough detox beds, in some cases there aren't enough detox beds. And Kate mentioned that these beds are located in Anchorage, in Juneau, in Fairbanks. We have a lot of individuals, a lot of clients that, so the substance abuse treatment provider recognizes kind of along Martha's story that she needs to go to detox or to go to withdrawal management. So they have to arrange the travel to get out there, figure out whatever kind of hang-ups there are to get the person there, coordinate with the withdrawal management centers to make sure that they've got a bed open and that bed is staffed. There's a lot that goes goes on behind the scenes to make this happen. And again, that speaks to the whole concert of treatment providers, not one-offs.
Okay. Thanks. We're just going to pause for a second and recognize Representative Tarr's join us and Representative Johnson has a question.
Yes, just could you clarify for me the difference between a management center and a detox center?
So the, yes, through the chair, Representative Johnston. So the older term that's kind of falling out of favor is detox. They're starting to relabel the term as withdrawal management. And I think that, and Ms. Burkhart could add on this, but it's partly in recognition of the fact that it's actually a much longer process if you just detox the person then and you don't consider the whole withdrawal management process. I think it's doing a disservice to the individual, and this is a national change that's happening.
And this is basically for some drugs and alcohol, but not necessarily. This isn't about opioids. And
I think that's an excellent, through the chair, it's an excellent question. So, in to the chair's opening remarks, the problems that alcohol has in the state of Alaska are particularly acute. The detox, many of the withdrawal management or detox beds that we had set up were for alcohol. Reason being that you can actually die from detoxing off alcohol. In many of the other drugs, assuming that there's not a direct physical problem, it was harder to die off of detoxing off of something else. That being said, because of the complicated clients that we're serving and seeing, there are a lot of new detox beds that are opening for other purposes, particularly detoxing off opioids. And our medical, these are all medically monitored services. It's important that the individual, you know, as they're detoxing off of whatever the drug is safe first and foremost.
Representative Sullivan.
Thank you. Just a quick question, please. With regard to the withdrawal management, I recognize that Matsu is not included on the list here, but if we are going to be discussing alcohol treatment, wouldn't Nugent Ranch be one that would be considered and on this list?
So, through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Nugent's Ranch is a residential program, not a withdrawal management program, and we'll talk about residential programs in a little bit. So, in addition to the logistics that Tom talked about, the travel and the timing and all of that, one of the issues that has to be addressed is where does Martha fit in the wait list process? So, as I talked about, the system we have, the system we fund, is prioritized partially by federal guidelines, which require pregnant injecting drug users to come first, and then other pregnant drug users, and then other injecting drug users. So they get top of the list, and Martha's not any of those. And then the state also prioritizes families engaged with the Office of Children's Services, and she doesn't fit that priority population. This won't happen to her in the story, but what is a common occurrence is someone gets on the list and they say, we'll have a bed in a week. And then Kate comes along, who's a pregnant IV drug user, and I get to go first. And so that bed that was going to be open in a week is now not open. And the person who thought they were going to get it has to wait longer. That's just how it works. So all of the withdrawal management centers are full, but a bed is supposed to come open in 3 weeks in Anchorage. Martha and her clinician work together to develop a plan to help her maintain her treatment readiness while she waits, because 3 weeks is a really long time to remember that you want to get treatment. She is nervous. We've talked about how she's worried about diverting from treatment, and so part of the plan is that her family members are going to take and wait with her at both the Village and the Hub airport. And then when she gets to the Anchorage airport, someone from the treatment provider is going to pick her up, and it's going to be great. And yet she still arrives at the airport so intoxicated she can't get on the plane. So her family member calls her treatment provider, who begs the withdrawal management program not to give up the bed. and begs the travel people to help reschedule the travel so that she can try again tomorrow. She spends the night with family. She manages to get to the airport, and this time she gets on the plane, and she's met at the airport in Anchorage so she can go to the withdrawal management program.
So Martha spends the next 7 days in Anchorage in a medically monitored, high-intensity, inpatient setting, a withdrawal management setting. The treatment team explores whether placement after that point at a residential setting closer to home following discharge is available, and it's the best treatment option for Martha. This is another point in Martha's journey to recovery. The discharge and placement process can either support or divert Martha's progress. This is one of the challenges that the treatment providers are constantly have. So now the individual is in treatment, and they've gone through your particular service setting, and they're ready for the next service setting, a step-down care. And so now you have to do this whole process all over again. Find some place that's available for them, make sure that the transportation and travel and bed and all that's lined up, and it's challenging for the case managers and for the counselors to keep doing this.
Also, it's important to recognize that the fact that Martha stayed all 7 days is a huge victory. A lot of people just walk out. And so there's also that issue that maintaining that treatment readiness, especially in the most acute time, is really difficult. And so this is not a standard story. It is a story.
It's an excellent point, and if I might add on to that, so these are all voluntary treatment programs. Sometimes there, you know, is a court mandate or an OCS family engagement plan or something in the background that's motivating this, but these are all voluntary programs. So a lot of times what happens is the individual will go to their level of treatment that's needed, they'll get along a little bit in the program, and they'll say, I feel better, I can go do this by myself, and then they leave the program. And the treatment provider is left saying, okay, well, not advised, but here's some things that might try to help you as much as possible in that scenario.
At this point, based on the clinical assessments and her progress in her withdrawal management program, Martha is ready for an intensive residential program. So there are 315 residential treatment beds, that's not providers, that's beds, in Alaska, and Nugent's Ranch is one of them. The residential treatment programs are not uniform, and they're not one size fits all. Some are for men only, some are for women only, some are co-ed. Some are for women with children. Some are longer than others. Representative Sullivan Leonard mentioned Nugent's Ranch. That's one of our longest programs. You can stay there months, if not years. And each one has tailored features for specific client populations. Again, we wanted to point out that we do have additional beds coming online for women with children in the MATSU thanks to this recent capital funding.
So while we're on this level of treatment, the residential substance abuse providers, it's important to point out the IMD exclusion. The IMD exclusion, or Institutions for Mental Diseases, is an exclusion that dates back to the 60s when Medicaid was first developed. It was to prevent the teardown of state psychiatric hospitals just to build community psychiatric hospitals. But recently, with the availability of treatment services to the substance abuse population, the substance abuse treatment system has run square into this exclusion with Medicaid. What it means is that if you're a treatment provider and you are a residential treatment provider with more than 16 beds, which is a lot of residential treatment providers, they can't bill Medicaid for the services that happen in that institution. So, as an example, Aquila House has more than 16 beds. The substance abuse treatment services that are happening in Aquila, they can't bill Medicaid for that. This is a federal rule. There has been a lot of discussion about substance abuse and how it fits in treatment services and how they fit into this rule, but it is a pretty hard and fast rule. Nugent's Ranch is an IMD. There are other IMDs. So one of the reasons that it's important to point this out is because our grant funding supports these organizations. They can't bill Medicaid. But the flat funding that we have in both the grant system and the Medicaid system, the cuts that we've had, kind of put a difficult strain on these residential treatment providers. Kate mentioned in the earlier slide there's 315 residential beds. Those are licensed beds. That's not staffed. So what happens is you've got 30 beds, but your funding has been cut over the years so that you can only adequately staff 15 of those beds. So technically on the books there are 30 beds, but we're only actually using 15 of them. I think I'm pointing this out because I think it's an opportunity. There is a fixed cost. There's an asset there that's not being fully utilized because of the funding levels.
So, excuse me, I want to take a moment just to step in and recognize that Representative Westlake has joined us, and also just to acknowledge the time. We started late, so I'm going to ask that you will sort of extend what was our original plan time, because I want to make sure that we cover all of this, and we'll have you go until 4:10. You can just sort of judge your time by that. Thanks.
Thank you.
So what if there's no residential treatment bed available? Or what if there's not one available on a realistic time horizon? So one option, and these are not either or options, they can actually be both and options, but one option is medication-assisted treatment, which is something that we're hearing more and more about, particularly related to opioid treatment. And when you heard from Dr. Sonkis, you heard a lot about how medication-assisted treatment works on the brain and how it works for people in a way to help them achieve and maintain recovery. Medication-assisted treatment is available for opioid dependence as well as alcohol dependence, and the research shows that it not only helps people stay in treatment, particularly the forms of MAT that require frequent contact. The longer between contacts, the harder it is to stay in treatment. It also can decrease the ancillary criminal activity related to your drug use, increase your employability. It's especially helpful if the person you're treating is pregnant. It improves outcomes for both the mother and the child, and it lowers the risk of contracting HIV or hepatitis C or other kinds of diseases by reducing the chance for relapse. It's available through some community health centers like Sunshine Clinic and South Central Foundation. It's also available through some community behavioral health centers and then private physicians' offices. Methadone is available in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Wasilla. The Fairbanks and Anchorage programs are state grantees, and the Wasilla program is a private company. The capacity in-state is being expanded thanks to federal funding that the Department of Health and Social Services has just received, well, not just received in the last several months, and will focus on building capacity in Anchorage and Juneau.
You have a question, Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going back on the medication-assisted treatment, are there some barriers to expanding that because of federal restrictions on providing those treatments? I feel like I read something, but I'm not up to speed.
Representative Tarr, through the chair. So not just anybody can provide medication-assisted treatment. So if a physician or a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant or someone wants to provide the treatment, they have to look at the options and then look at how they want to be credentialed and whether they're even allowed. So the methadone programs are the most rigorously regulated programs. The amount of work they have to do in order to function is just exhausting. And they have to not only be licensed by the state, but also by the federal government, and have all kinds of interaction with the Drug Enforcement Agency, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, among other federal regulators. For physicians who want to provide clinic or office-based services, they too have to have training and be specially credentialed by CMSA. They are regulated by the Drug Enforcement Agency as well as state and other federal authorities, and there are limits to how many clients they can serve. So I wouldn't be doing my job as the State Planning Council if I didn't point out that many of these medications that are used for medication-assisted treatment are also effective for pain management. And while there are pretty strict limits on the number of clients you can serve with medication-assisted treatment, there are no limits on the pain management practices. So they can serve many, many more people. So same medication, different regulatory structures. But you're right, you can't just serve whoever you want, as many people as you want, and you have to be willing to go through really rigorous credentialing and regulation to do it, which is not appealing to everybody.
Thank you.
So Martha is ready for residential, and there's a program in her home community that's the appropriate clinical level and would be culturally relevant. It's co-ed, and they have an opening in about 2 weeks. Well, she cannot hang out at the Withdrawal Management Center for 2 weeks. That's our most expensive service, and it's the most in demand, and it wouldn't be clinically appropriate. And so she can't stay there, and she can't get into her treatment program for 2 weeks. And so you should have lots of warning bells going off. That's an opportunity for her to divert off of her recovery journey. So she has to come up with a plan. And so she works with her staff at the Withdrawal Management Center, her behavioral health provider in her home community, and a case manager, and they come up with this plan that she's going to go back to her hub community, and she's not just going to stay with family, because remember what her history's like and that her family and social networks actually enabled her use. She found a family friend who's sober and who's willing to commit to help her stay sober for the 2 weeks it takes to get there. And the program where she's planning to go has AA every night, and so she's going to go every night. And that also helps her establish a relationship with the treatment provider.
So we're stepping down from the withdrawal management services through some supportive services while she's waiting for residential treatment. Just briefly, now she's in a residential treatment setting. She's in there for 6 weeks. After residential treatment, again, the residential substance abuse treatment provider would need to discharge her to a step-down level of care, an outpatient treatment provider perhaps. But at each of these steps, there's a bunch of risks that the person might divert from the road to recovery. And the counselors and the clinicians and everybody working with her, hopefully, are identifying those triggers and those things that might not keep her on that road to recovery and working with her to support that. And that could be housing and employment or a myriad of things. Also, it's often scary for folks that are transitioning from a residential structured substance abuse treatment setting to an outpatient treatment setting. I know that when I talk to the substance abuse treatment providers, but also many of the clients, that's a scary part.
And it's scary because this is an opportunity for relapse. And so part of your treatment plan is a relapse prevention plan. It's something that is just part of what the work is that you do with your clinician. So she has one, and she's talked to her clinician about her triggers. And she knows that when she goes to this family birthday party where everybody's going to be drinking, it's going to be really hard, but she wants to go. It's her family. I mean, who would want to miss a family birthday party? So she goes. And she makes it through most of the evening, and then one beer is not going to hurt. And she passes out. She drinks until she blacks out. The next day, she's really hungover, and so a friend says, here, take some prescription opiate, and it'll make you feel better. Well, she's used these before, right? She knows how they work, and she takes as many as she used to. After 60 to 75 days of sobriety, she doesn't have the same tolerance she had before, and so she overdoses. And this happens really, really frequently with folks who don't understand that their tolerance has waned with their prolonged sobriety, and then when they use at the same level, especially with opiates, they overdose.
So she does overdose with the opiates. Thankfully, the first responders have Narcan on board, thanks to Senate Bill 23 last year and some extraordinary efforts by the administration. We're really promoting Narcan in the communities, and particularly appreciate the fact that folks have mentioned that Narcan will save a life, but it is not treatment. So Martha's life is saved from the overdose, and she goes to talk with her outpatient treatment provider to talk about options of what to do next. The outpatient treatment provider suggests going into a residential treatment program for a little bit longer of a stay, and she has to wait to get 10 days. I feel like this is a board game where there's a bunch of circles, and as we said before, it's not a linear process.
I'm the car. So she decides to go away. She doesn't go back to the same residential program because she's identifying she's having some struggles staying on the road she's chosen at home. So she goes to a different treatment provider, and it's one that has additional levels of aftercare that she could transition to in that community. So she goes, she's successful in the treatment. She connects with a support network of other people in recovery, which is really, really important. Having healthy and stable social networks to help you maintain your recovery are essential. She understands that she'd really rather be home in her hometown, but that's just not going to work for her. The case manager helps her, in addition to working through the levels of treatment, find stable housing, connect with the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation so that she can become employed. She starts working with a primary care provider about her actual health conditions and not necessarily the ones that she was bringing forward before. And she's finding healthy things to do in the community that don't involve going to bars or hanging out with friends and drinking. She makes it a year sober. She has a job. She has stable housing. She's going to her 12-step meetings three or four times a week. For many people, even in long-term recovery, they go to meetings multiple times a week. It becomes part of how they stay connected, and not only for themselves but support each other. She's seeing a mental health professional to address the underlying mental health issues that had been masked by her drug and alcohol use. And many of the skills she's learning in her mental health therapy help her deal with the triggers that can lead her to drink or want to use. And she gets to the point where she's strong enough in her recovery that she wants to go home. And for folks, especially who achieve their recovery in a new environment, going home is a big deal and can be an opportunity to really address many triggers. But she's able to do it, and they have a good visit.
So you earlier in the legislative session heard from the Division of Behavioral Health, and I hope the next few slides you'll see them as dovetailing with a lot of DBH's efforts. The Division of Behavioral Health, of course, would give a more of a system approach, more of a macro view. We just have a few slides here to offer kind of the provider perspective and what we're working on. So several points along Martha's journey to recovery hinted at problems that she had accessing treatment. Access, in fact, is one of the things that our entire healthcare system, to include our behavioral health system, is focused on. It's often referred to as the triple aim. It's access, quality, and cost. And the behavioral health providers and the association, the Division of Behavioral Health, the state planning councils, we're all focused on this essential problem and essential question. I appreciate the Rubik's Cube kind of I've never been able to figure those out even still, but I'm hopeful that there is some configuration that will address the patient provider stigma, that will reduce administrative burden that the treatment providers have, so that more resources dedicated to substance abuse treatment can actually go to substance abuse treatment. That will fix the reimbursement problem that we have that has led to a system that pushes folks into corrections, that pushes folks into the emergency departments, and that pushes folks into higher level care. Something that will address our workforce shortages and our workforce capacity issues, and something that helps with both the access to the treatment services as well as those transition points along the way. It's my wish list. It's my Christmas list every year.
So you heard previously back in February from Dr. Sonkis about the science of addiction. And one of the other things I've learned from Dr. Sonkis is that when we talk about the stigma related to substance abuse, we often focus on the stigma that attaches to the person. So Kate is a bad person. That's that stigma. Less, I think, apparent until you really dig into it is that the stigma that we associate with people who experience substance use disorders themselves attaches to the people that provide them health care. And so the folks that engage in the provision of whether it's substance use disorder treatment or even mental health services, the stigmas that we as a society attach to their clients attach to them. And I don't know why I didn't realize that until recently, but it really does attach to them. And you see it in several ways. You see it not only in how they are treated within their profession by their colleagues, but also how we as a system reimburse them, the level of oversight we require of them. If you compare the level of oversight for other specialty healthcare providers like dentists and optometrists to what we require of substance use disorder and mental health providers, it is not even two fruits. I mean, it's like apples and elephants. And so that also leads to, when we talk about workforce, it's hard for someone who themselves is in recovery to enter this field, right? Because we've already stigmatized them as a person who had a disorder, and we don't really treat the providers very well, and then we have issues around who we let provide these services with our background check requirements and all of that. So really the takeaway there is that the stigma is beyond just the person. It actually affects pretty much everybody involved in helping that person.
So to illustrate this example, I spoke about the administrative burden a couple of slides ago. Roughly 75% of the resources that go to behavioral health providers go to the actual treatment. About 25% is all the other stuff that we need to do to provide the treatment. All of the behavioral health providers in the state of Alaska are required to be accredited by a national accrediting body. So according to our state statute and regs, it is in Alaska, the Joint Commission, CARF, which does actually stand for something, and COA, which also does stand for something. So each of our mental health and drug and alcohol providers are required to be accredited by these national quality assuring organizations. The Behavioral Health Provider Association, the Division of Behavioral Health, and the Planning Council, the boards, came together in 2014 to try to streamline some of this administrative burden, to put more of the resources that were meant for behavioral health treatment to behavioral health treatment. The streamlining initiative, I think, was a perfect example of a private-public partnership that benefited the state, that benefited the providers, and that benefited the people receiving care. It's one example of many where I think that partnership could yield benefits across groups. Kate mentioned the workforce, the stigma that attaches to the workforce. We've got several groups that are working on workforce capacity. It's one of the number one reasons that we in Alaska can't meet the need. We've got substance use disorder counselors, clinicians, and treatment providers, and we are constantly recruiting. If you know anyone that needs a job, send them my way. I will certainly find them a place to work. It is actually also the Alaska Department of Labor pointed out that it was one of the only areas of growth in our entire economy last year and projected to be the only area of growth for our economy next year. These are good paying jobs, oftentimes with benefits, in communities across the state. When the private substance abuse treatment providers, the corporations that provide these services, receive funding from the state, most of that funding goes to employing individuals. We don't have big fancy MRIs and x-ray machines and stuff to buy. They're counselors and clinicians. So when the state provides grant funding for services through the private substance abuse treatment providers, we in turn hire staff to provide those services.
So the peer support workforce is a relatively untapped opportunity. So this is folks who have what they call lived experience. They are in recovery, and they provide a whole host of support services, and they can be a form of case management, sometimes not intensive targeted case management, but here, Kate, go over here today, kinds of case management. And they're effective. I mean, it is actually an evidence-based practice to use people with lived experience to provide services. Some of the hurdles are that the criminal background check, it is not unusual for someone in recovery to have a felony, and then that can disqualify them from all sorts of healthcare professions. We do reimburse peer support through the community behavioral health centers. So if you're a Medicaid provider, a community behavioral health center, you can bill for peer support. However, we don't credential our peer support providers, and so as we try to figure out how to better utilize them in the system, we'll have to figure out a way to credential them and to expand the ability for them to be reimbursed. Telehealth, which you've heard about in other presentations, is a critical component to the behavioral health system and is often used by substance use disorder treatment providers, often to tap into expertise outside. And integration of healthcare to allow for primary care practices to help understand when Martha is in need and to do that initial screening and then to make that connection, or even to provide services, are areas where we can help enhance our workforce.
So in the interest of time, I'm going to Kate mentioned the stigma that attaches to substance use treatment providers, and we're going to talk about reimbursement a bit more on the next slide. So right now, your substance abuse treatment providers are predominantly funded by UGF, by unrestricted grant funds. There's some designated grant funding that goes to it from the alcohol tax that's in existence today, and some federal money that comes through. But by and large, it's grant funding that pays for the substance abuse treatment services. That's changing with Medicaid expansion. Individuals that would not have been qualified for Medicaid in the past because of the Social Security Administration's way of qualifying people for, and it didn't exist for substance abuse basically. Now with an income eligibility, a lot of individuals that were not eligible for Medicaid in the past are now eligible. So just like the individuals are changing, our treatment system is changing from predominantly grant-funded to transitioning more to a Medicaid reimbursement requirement. The issue is that Medicaid rates don't actually cover the cost of care. They pay for like 60 cents on the dollar, and so they're using the grant funds to help offset that 40 cents. This is a problem with both the mental health and the substance abuse treatment system. The rates, the last time the rates were touched was 2006. Prior to that was in the 90s. So if you can imagine the struggles that we're having with that system, it is something that we are working very hard to try to change, and thankfully have the support of the department and the division in our efforts to correct that problem. But also remember that there are some services that Medicaid will not pay for, example, the IMD that we talked about earlier. So it's a very delicate balance. I'd be happy to talk with any of you more about what our efforts are to try to fix that situation.
We've talked about all the points in Martha's journey where it was potentially a place where she could fall off her track or keep moving forward. And part of why those transitions are the way they are is we cannot possibly provide every service in every community. It's not feasible. And so we have to ensure that the services we do provide are able to work together to try to meet the need of the state as a whole. So each one is a critical component to a larger system of care. It's a customized approach to meeting the needs of individual clients. It's not one size fits all. Just like the rest of healthcare typically isn't one size fits all. And so it is often challenging for clinicians to find the best resources available and then for the resources to fit the needs and the place where the person is in their life. There are some services that can help folks navigate to treatment if they're not already hooked into a healthcare provider, or honestly, if they are. One of them is Alaska 211. About 7 years ago, the department, it started encouraging all of the treatment providers to enroll with Alaska 211 so that when you call and say, my friend Kate needs treatment, who do I call? They can help you find something, if not in your community, hopefully close to your community. Recover Alaska, which is focused primarily on alcohol, has a referral service co-located with Alaska 211. So there's some additional expertise now at Alaska 211. There's also a treatment finder from SAMHSA that you can access through our website or through our office to help folks. And we do actually get calls periodically from folks saying, where do we send Kate? Sometimes the answer is not always the answer you want, though. So, first of all, substance use disorders are incredibly complex, and it's not an easy process to provide the services the person needs, and it's not an easy process for the person to actually work through the process. They have not only their behavioral health needs, but their physical needs, if they've been using a long time. There's a whole host of physical needs and their social needs, and hopefully Martha's story helped illuminate what those might look like. It's not an easy system to navigate, even if you live in it. And if you don't live in it, it's really, really kind of Mandarin. There are multiple transition points where you can get derailed. One of the things, though, that I think it's important to understand is that just as the treatment providers that were in the story and that Tom has talked about work together to meet the need, the department, the Behavioral Health Association, the boards, and a whole host of other stakeholders are doing the same thing. It may look like a big pile of sausage, but it's actually a pretty strong relationship even when it gets to be a little thorny. And I do think we've seen improvements in the system over time, in the numbers of people served and the quality of services they provide.
410.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Johnston.
Yeah, I've written quite a few, but I'll try to keep it short. One is, what do you think the possibility of the waiver happening?
The 1115?
Yes. Okay. Has anybody been, I mean, I've understood that actually our U.S. Senator feels it's not possible.
Oh.
It's not looking
Which
good.
One?
I understood that Senator Murkowski was not hopeful.
I think I heard.
So anyway, that's just one. That being said, you know, I think we have to be prepared for that.
So it's Representative Johnston through the chair. So I participate in the writing team for the 1115 concept paper as well as the policy team, and I have several board members participating, and Tom has several members participating. So we have had a conversation with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I think that they responded positively to what we've laid out in the concept paper, which is that in their packet?
It is.
It's in your packet. I think everyone understands that healthcare policy at the federal level is up in the air right now, not only based on what might happen in Congress, but what might happen at the secretary level. And so we're just trying to be prepared for all of that, but we are moving forward. And so, I mean, it's that whole thing about you can only control what you can control. And so we are moving forward with the process. The timeline that was shared at the last policy team meeting was the application would be submitted this summer. And but we do all understand that federal healthcare policy right now is a moving target.
Through the chair, follow up.
Go ahead.
I, for free reading on Friday night on the airplane, I was reading the so exciting. The grant book.
That's exciting.
And I got to page 94 out of 124 or something. But it was interesting to read that, and we all should look at it. First of all, it's interesting in the fact that the duplication and the intertwining of grants, I mean, it seems to me to not be a very clear system. I can see as I'm reading it, I can kind of see legislative intent in some of these grants. I can see, anyways, it's, I think we need to readdress the ones we can have. A lot of this is UGF. A lot of it isn't federal pass-through. And I think it's time to sort of look at those grants and how best to. I am 100% behind nonprofits, but when I see grants that are $100 or I see grants that are up to, you know, millions of dollars, and then I don't see anything in the grant book as far as how we benchmark it, how we, and I know, I'm quite familiar with mental health. And you know, when you're saying the stigma, I think you're being a little unfair. It's because we, none of us have the answers. And so that's not a stigma of the profession. It's more that the profession isn't like filling a tooth.
Right. Could we try to limit our questions to those items which the presenters have expertise
right.
but
in?
Just in the interest of time.
You were bringing up the UGF funding, and I just wonder if you could address some. I mean, I don't know if you've looked at the grant book.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I have. In fact, I've actually looked at all of the FY16 grants to see who got what and how much money. I just, because you mentioned the $100 grants, so that's a holdover from that you had to be a grantee in order to bill Medicaid. And so it was a way to help people bill Medicaid more. So those de minimis grants, that's the whole point in those. I do think the division is more able to speak to how they benchmark things and implement performance-based funding. And they can speak to that.
Okay, thank you. There are other committee members that have questions?
Just can I make just a real quick point?
Representative Minchman?
It's pretty quick. Thanks for the presentation. It was very effective, the storyline. But unfortunately, I think this also helps illustrate, Representative Westlake can identify with this, that Martha could have had kids. She could have been an FASD baby herself. There could be a boyfriend. There could be domestic violence involved. Mm-hmm. The mother, who knows, might have been FASD herself. You know, this is an inherently complicated issue and perhaps even more so than what's presented here. But appreciate the presentation.
Do you have any questions? All right. Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one other quick question, kind of on where Representative Johnston was going, and I can understand why you feel the way you do, because sometimes when I've tried to study it, it sort of seems like this group does the same as that group, does the same as that group, but I think what I've come to understand is it's just the need far exceeds the amount of services available, and so, you know, why it looks like there's duplication, it's really because, you know, all the groups added together are only providing 200 of the 300 people that need services, or something like that. And I just wonder, as far as the model of delivery goes, on some of these, it, you know, it seems to me that you probably can't get to be too big without sort of losing the personal touch and the really intensive, you know, sort of management that needs to go along with helping the person through that recovery process. So I guess before I used to think, well, what if we just had one organization that did, you know, many more services? But I guess I'm just, the question is sort of like, does that model work, or is it more that you need to have smaller, more focused, and that's why we might see, you know, more organizations providing what seems like maybe the same kind of services?
So through the chair, Representative Tarr, two quick points. Your comment about the capacity to meet the services not being on par with the demand for the services is spot on. I mean, the 34 withdrawal management beds for 740,000 people is an example of that. Each of the treatment providers work to employ evidence-based practices, and some of the models that they use are in smaller settings. Mm-hmm. There are cohorts, there are, you know, men's only program, women's only program, women and children. Other programs, there's a therapeutic community where it can incorporate more people. It really depends on, you know, what the client needs first and foremost, and then what treatment program might get them to that need for best. If there are programs that you guys have in your mind that look duplicative, come talk to me about them, because I can oftentimes shed some light on how they are different. And it may just be simply one serves a kid's population and one serves an adult population, or there are a million different shades of these things. So, mm-hmm.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, I just wanted to say thank you for your presentation. I think Martha was certainly a very clear description of anyone throughout Alaska, and I think you pulled that all together very, very well. The one component I didn't see in here with regard to treatment is our faith-based groups throughout the state. I've talked to a few people in Department of Corrections where their faith-based treatment within the correctional facility actually works very well. Can you expand on that just real quickly on how that may be utilized?
Yes, ma'am. So Representative Sullivan Leonard, through the chair, we actually have state programs that are faith-based, like Set Free Alaska in the Mat-Su Valley is a faith-based program. It's one of these new residential programs that's coming online. Christian Health Associates is another example. So they often are part of the system. Really and truly, the requirements to be part of the system are the same for everybody, whether they're faith-based or not. They're clinical and accreditation kinds of requirements. And we do find that having the choice to pursue, and that's one thing we haven't talked about is choice. If there's only one doctor in town and he's a real curmudgeon and he doesn't work for you, then you're kind of left out. And so especially for something like substance use disorder treatment, having the option of a faith-based program or a women's-only program that fits you better means you're more likely to succeed. So I appreciate that you brought them up.
Any other questions? I have one of my own. One of the biggest concerns that I have with regard to our system right now, let me back up for a second. I appreciate your bringing up the question, Representative Sullivan Leonard, and the opportunity to talk about sort of the palette of options, and that, you know, addiction treatment is a very personal experience, and what you need to do is to find a treatment experience that lines up with your values and, you know, what's really going to be resonant for you. And so I think that's very important. But one of the biggest gaps, and we saw it a couple of times in Martha's story, is sort of the pauses necessary for treatment, and I think people that are experts in the field, I worked recently for the Salvation Army. We had two separate treatment programs, one which was a faith-based program, and one which was a more traditional clinical model. And the biggest challenge that we often ran into was that people would show up, they'd be ready for treatment at one particular time, but if we didn't have space for them right away, they often would relapse or would go AWOL, essentially AWOL. So they'd get on the list and then we couldn't find them when the bed was available. And I wonder if there's been any research that's been done that addresses solutions to that. If that's simply a capacity problem and that we have to have a little elasticity built into the system, kind of like you do with hospital beds, so you always make sure that you have a few empty beds just in case you hit that maximum capacity, or if there's other solutions that I'm not aware of.
Thank you for that question. So I think your point about elasticity is definitely one of the important factors that you'll want to build into your system. There aren't enough treatment providers and treatment programs for the need. That's the bottom line. I was sitting with Dr. Butler last week, and we were kind of trying to figure out the opioid crisis and how to fix this, and we were talking about withdrawal management beds, and I made the comment that we can stand on our head and look at the system 42 different ways, but the bottom line is they cost money, services cost money, you need to figure out some way to get resources there. I will say that innovations in telemedicine, innovations in some of the peer support workforce that we spoke about, making sure that the counselors and clinicians are working with the client to find the local resources and get them available. Frankly, resources like 2-on-1 and being able to point to something that helps with those transitions of care and access to care. These are all things that I think are helping to address that essential question.
And to add to that, we tried really hard to keep the presentation on a system level. But I think one area that we don't explore enough, especially in our smaller communities, is in those situations, there are opportunities to wrap around someone with the natural helpers in the community and the resources that might be available from tribal organizations or their extended family. And so we didn't we didn't really focus on that. It was just Martha, right? But we did talk about how, you know, we found somebody to help her stay sober during those transition points. I think the work that has been done around behavioral health aides builds on those natural, inherent helper people in the village. But as a system, I don't know that we've gone beyond that to start looking at, so if Kate's got to wait 2 weeks, how are we as a community going to wrap around her to keep her safe and on the road until that opens up? We kind of just leave it to her family, hopefully. So I think there's opportunities there.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time today and your flexibility in coming back. We're going to take a very brief at ease to give time for a transition, and then we're going to hear from Representative Westlake on his bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Record at 429. Thank you so much, Mr. Westlake and Mr. Wolf, for joining us today to talk about HB 38, designating March as Sobriety Awareness Month. You want to go ahead and present your bill?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Representative Dean Westlake, House District 40, and thank you for hearing House Bill 138 today. House Bill 38 designates the month of March each year as Sobriety Awareness Month. We want to help the Marthas that you just heard about and the Garys that we all know and the Bills, you know, those people that have struggled and have made it. This provides the opportunity for schools, community groups, and other entities to recognize, appreciate, and celebrate those Alaskans that choose to live a life in sobriety. Individuals that lead sober lives are an asset to Alaska, and they can help reduce the incidence of alcohol or drug-related social ills such as crime, recidivism, domestic violence, child abuse, and neglect. Please help me there are several celebrations that happened. I was at EOC Corporation last fall, and it was just a wonderful feeling that all these people coming together. There was I think they started at 49 years sobriety, going all the way down, doing it year by year, and it was such an empowering thing to listen to these people. I heard one young man out there that says, as a high school student, I sat here as a high school student 2 years ago, thinking it could never happen to me. Now I'm here addressing you. So being able to do these and helping people celebrate sober lives I'm really proud to sponsor this bill, and I'll refer to my staffer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon again. For the record, my name is Forrest Wolf, and I'm obviously staff to Representative Westlake here. I don't really have too much to add. I'll just add a quick little thing here. In your bill packets, I provided a copy of some language from AS 4737010, which is also known as the Uniform Alcoholism and Intoxication Act. Under a declaration of policy, the first sentence reads, "It is the policy of the state to recognize, appreciate, and reinforce the example set by its citizens who lead, believe in, and support a life of sobriety." We feel that by permanently designating March as Sobriety Awareness Month, HB 138 will help the state of Alaska meet this declaration of policy. Thank you again for hearing this bill today. I do have one individual, I think, online. His name is Gregory Nofstein. He's a guy who actually helped bring this issue to our attention, and he helped kind of craft some of our intent language we have in the bill as well. So I'd like to, if possible, give him a chance to kind of put himself on record. I think he has some good comments for us.
Mr. Nofstein, are you online?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Nofstein.
For the record, my name is Gary Rothstein. I'm the president of the Southern Youth Revival of Our Spirit Nonprofit Organization. And we did, and we're aware that the Alaska Legislature was the first in the nation to pass such a statute recognizing the appreciation and the reinforcement of individuals and citizens who do that sobriety. And for several years, at least, there was resolutions passed every year declaring about the March of Sobriety Awareness Month today. And it's a small gesture that there were a bunch of signatures that mushers would take, and they're certain, like Mike Williams and Randy Brooks. And the symbolic gesture that this was a series of commitments necessary to help cure the devastating effects of alcohol and drugs and throughout many of our communities. But the thing that I want to bring to light is that we have a lot of non-consumers of substances being legal or illegal. And we've got elders and senior citizens who have never had to drink or drive any kind of substances, but yet we do little or nothing to recognize their contribution and effort to building a safer community. And this particular bill would help do such a thing. I mean, at this point in time, we're probably spending millions and millions of dollars on treatment centers. We've already heard the challenges that are involved in that. And in the same breath, we could also be reinforcing the appreciation of citizens throughout our communities and cities who basically are contributing to the problem. I think that's one gap for Alaska's nation and being able to at least look at. So I'm in total support of this bill and hope that the committee will pass it through.
All right. Does anybody on the committee have any questions for either the bill's sponsor or Mr. Forrester or Mr. Noste? Representative Johnston.
Could I make a comment?
I'd be disappointed if you didn't.
I'm glad that this is March. Years ago, I started a ski program up in the Arctic Northwest in March because I find spring can be a very stressful time. And it can be a time when things like alcohol really rears its ugly head and suicide. And if we can have celebrations and have festivals in March, and I would say very much in your region, I think it would be great, and I strongly support it.
Anybody else?
Real quick, like in the last part of through the chair, in the last part of the bill, I'll just put it out there as food for thought. I don't think it's particularly germane, but it occurs to me that the word tribes could be added in there, or you know,
yeah,
could be. Thank you, and I guess I'll just add some remarks. You know, I personally have been sober for 14 years, and I'm really proud of that. And I think that that celebrating sobriety as a really healthy lifestyle choice for Alaskans is a step sort of moving in the right direction, I think, for our community and giving people the opportunity to come together in March every year and not just bringing this forward once a year for approval again by the legislature, but making it a dedicated forever thing, I think showed some commitment on behalf of our state, and I'm very supportive and pleased to see that you would introduce this. It is my intent, because I typically wouldn't introduce and pass out a bill on the first day, that we'll hold it over one more day and we'll schedule some public testimony to give members of the community an opportunity to express their thoughts on the subject. And with that, we'll just thank you and look forward to having you back again shortly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And with that, I believe that in the room we have staffer Representative Jason Gren coming up to talk about HB 43, New Drugs for the Terminally Ill. Welcome, Brooke Ivey, if you can put yourself on the record and recap the bill for us today.
Certainly. For the record, Brooke Ivey, staff to Representative Gren. And apologies, Representative Gren is currently in finance doing budget amendments. So I apologize. He apologizes for not being able to be here. So just to recap on House Bill 43, also known as the Right to Try, essentially, this bill would help streamline an existing process through the FDA called the Compassionate Use Program that allows those who have been diagnosed as terminally ill and cannot access investigational medications through a clinical trial process the option of trying those investigational drugs outside of a clinical trial process in an effort to save their own lives. This bill would allow terminally ill patients to work directly with their doctor and the manufacturer, give an informed consent to access those treatments. So that's kind of the long and short of it.
All right, thank you. Is there any questions for Ms. Ivey? All right, seeing none, we will go ahead and open up the bill again for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? All right, seeing none, we're going to look and see, is there anybody online who would like to testify? were you expecting anybody? Okay. All right. Seeing no more individuals wishing to testify, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. Now we'll move to committee discussion and amendments. Are there any amendments? All right. I guess seeing none, I would entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 43 from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Is there any objection?
Objection.
Would you like to speak to your objection?
Yes. In reviewing the language of the bill, it seems that there definitely is a very wide gap between the purposes for which the drug is tested and the actual uses that we are now giving physicians immunity for, and that's concerning to me.
Is there any other comments? All right. Would the clerk please like to call the roll?
Representative Pito?
Yes.
Representative Edgman?
Yes.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Sullivan Leonard?
Yes.
Representative Tarr?
Yes.
Chair Spombles?
Yes.
Seven yeas.
All right. With the seven yeas, we're going to go ahead and pass this out today. Please don't forget to stay and sign the paperwork. On Thursday, we'll be taking public testimony on HB 25, which is insurance coverage for contraceptives, as well as public testimony on HB 123, healthcare price transparency. And then finally, we'll be taking invited and public testimony on HCR 3, as well as introduction of that Child Abuse Prevention Month for April 2017. And the time is 4:30. We still got done early, and this hearing of House Health and Social Services is now adjourned.